So we were discussing earlier about Genesis playing live these days, and there were two things of note from a video that I saw from the year of our Lord 2021 of the band Genesis performing live.
Okay.
They were playing Invisible Touch, and yes, it was pitched down significantly from the original version. And I've got a question about this performance afterwards, but the interesting thing that I learned is apparently even on the original tour for that album, they never played it in the studio key. It was always transposed down.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if, I wonder if there was some like slowing down of the tapes to try to get his, range up there. Cause that is a pretty, high register tune. That's a belter.
Yeah. That's one you don't try to do at karaoke.
Yeah.
So the thing that I wanted to ask about, does Phil Collins have like any health problems right now?
Other than he's 69?
Yeah, he's just old. I think that's it. He's just old, and he's been touring with, you know, his, you know, Genesis and his solo act for, you know, 50 years now.
Well, all right, so here's the reason that I ask this. In this 2021 performance of Invisible Touch, he was seated in a chair the entire time.
Oh, boy.
Jesus Christ. So I now know what it's like to love something so much. Today, Rigby took a shit and apparently had eaten some of Emily's hair. And he had a turd hanging by one of Emily's hairs from his anus. And I had to put my hand down and pull the hair out.
Oh, boy.
I would do anything for that little rascal.
I've had to do that probably about 5 times total for Soli now, because she'll get into like Danielle's string and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, there'll just be like a little string that's not quite exiting the anus properly.
But the look on his face.
I don't touch it with my bare hands though, like you. Oh. You are going down a weird path. That's what you're doing. Going down a weird path. I used the doggy bag to like.
Oh no! Like I didn't have anything. We're in the backyard, and it's like I wasn't about to run in the house because the look on his face was just like, please help me. And I was like, I can't leave him. Can't leave you, bro.
I got you, man. Band of brothers.
Yeah.
We're in the trenches together, pulling hair out of each other's anuses.
I know if I had a hair coming out of my ass, he'd help me. So.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. He would retrieve the hair from your ass. That's what Labrador Retrievers were bred for.
Yeah. Ass hair retrieval.
Yeah. Hey, listen, it was a real problem
in Labrador.
Yeah, in Labrador, Canada? Is that what that is? Yeah, Newfoundland?
Yeah. I was telling Emily today because I finally turned the heat on in the house, even though I was trying to make it till November. And, so I turned the heat on. She was like, good. Rigby and I were cold. I was like, Rigby wasn't cold. He's fucking Canadian.
Yeah, he was fine. No, he's one of those dogs. No, he's not a St. Bernard. No, he doesn't have one of those big barrels of liquor to keep him warm.
Is that what you think? That the dogs are drinking that?
Yeah. That's how they fuel themselves.
Sorry, I'm the asshole.
They just get fucking blotto before they go out and rescue anyone. Otherwise, they have no empathy whatsoever, but they get drunk and suddenly they think they can do anything.
Yeah, they get really self-conscious about their rescuing abilities, so they have to have a few drinks before they go out and try to rescue someone that's in trouble.
Little confidence juice. You got this, buddy.
That's right. I just fucking realized what you guys were talking about. I totally forgot about that.
Oh yeah, that's St. Bernard's.
Fucking barrel around their neck.
The barrel around their neck. I mean, I don't know if this is an actual thing or just like a cartoon mythical trope, but
I think it was a thing.
I think it was a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, they'd run and find you, I mean, liquor is terrible for you in terms of like, you know, keeping you warm. It actually like fucks with your ability to maintain temperature or some shit like that, or like brings your temperature down or something.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It does the opposite of what people thought it was going to do.
Yeah, there was a lot of medical advice back in the 1800s, wasn't it?
So yes, this was apparently it was not a real thing. However, there is historically recorded one dog who did carry brandy. I don't know much about this dog because I don't want to read some 19th century writings on him right now. I feel like that's the last thing I need to be doing at 9:30 at night. But yeah, there was one dog, and it was involved with a monastery in some way, shape, or form, which probably shouldn't surprise you if he's hauling brandy around.
So there's possibly an unreliable narrator to this historical fact that we found. Because, I mean, those guys were fucking hammered, weren't they? Monks? Or they couldn't drink. They could only brew. Or could they drink?
Something like that. I don't know.
They could make the beer, but
I know. Yeah, I know they were making beer. I don't know if they were drinking it. I would assume they were drinking it, too. How the fuck do you know it's good if you're not sampling the goods, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so I just bit the bullet and kind of read through here. Here's the little nuggets of wisdom that you need to know. The dog's name was, in fact, Barry.
Wow, okay. Irishman.
Yeah, he apparently was a rescue dog in his life. He saved the lives of 40 individuals. Uh-huh. And whenever the mountain was enveloped in fogs and snow, he set out in search of lost travelers. He was he was accustomed to run barking until he lost breath and would frequently venture out on the most perilous places. When he found his strength was insufficient to draw from the snow, a traveler, benumbed with cold, he would run back to the hospital in search of the monks.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
It's a hell of a dog.
Yeah. That sounds like a movie, In Search of the Monks. But it's like,
yes, it does.
But it's like a futuristic Alvin and the Chipmunks thing, where like the chipmunks have disappeared off of the earth, and like, you know, they're like, we gotta bring the chipmunks back, man. And it's just the search of the monks. I've had a bit to drink.
So it's gonna be a fun
episode.
I have bad news though, in terms of how they decided to pay tribute to this particular dog, Barry.
Okay. Did they eat him?
Did they bury him alive?
No, they stuffed him, deposited him in the museum of the town, and the little phial of brandy that he carried around with him, they put that around his neck. So,
well, I mean, he lives on forever.
And that
I'm going to stuff
installment of Very Good Boys, a podcast about good boys. I wish. No, yeah, this isn't a dog podcast.
Sully's on the mend. Sully's on the mend, which is good, because she actually was scaring us the other day because she was so lethargic. Like, she sleeps a lot anyway. She sleeps like probably 16 hours a day. But this was like, she would get up to go to the bathroom and eat. And then other than that, she was just lying there with like her eyes mostly closed because they were so bloodshot. And I don't know if you guys have gone onto the internet to look up symptoms of things for dogs. But it is worse than going to WebMD for yourself and self-diagnosing. Oh, it's worse.
Well, that was like...
You go on there and it's just like, oh, cool, your dog's eyes are red. It's going to die. Yeah. Get it to the vet now.
No, that's like when we first got Rigby, you know, he's out in the yard and he's eating things. And I'm like trying to identify this. And I was like, everything in the yard is like, this will kill him. This will kill him. Like, what the fuck? Like, he can't eat anything in the yard? Like, Christ. Like, I had to rip
him. That was a big thing. Duke was like, you know, having a good time outside, you know. He's been shy, but finally opening up outside, and we're just like kind of letting him play, and he started eating acorns, and I'm like, I wonder if acorns are okay for dogs to eat, and nope, it's poisonous or something like that.
Everything is. I mean, you know what it is, though? It's like, I'm sure if he ate one or two, it'd be fine. I think it's like these dogs that get into like a fucking squirrel's nest, and they just fucking go on an acorn feast. Yeah, that'd probably
eat too much of anything in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's literally anything. Eggs, peanuts, cashews.
They can eat eggs.
But like...
Yeah, eggs are actually good for their coat.
No, I mean like, but if they ate like, you know, 900 eggs, it would probably hurt them.
Yeah, it would also hurt a person.
That's what I'm saying. Too much of anything is a bad thing. you eat enough kale and it will kill you, for Christ's sakes. It's really funny though. I'm glad to hear that Sully's doing better. Our cat Gunter had like a week long. It was hilarious because the other two cats had them and then gave Gunter the virus last, and like he was, you know, fucking laid out for about a week, and he's such a priss, and like, you know, he's a cat, so he's obsessed with cleaning himself and like looking clean, but he was like too lazy and like just lethargic to do anything. So he got all like scraggly and just unkempt. And, you know, he just fucking hated it because he's so vain. It was one of the most pathetic things I'd ever seen, but it was also pretty funny because he's fucking a stupid cat butt face. Everybody make fun of him. Everybody dial in 4123-2648 to let me know whether or not Gunter is a stupid smelly butt face.
I was really hoping that that was a number two that just sounded like T-O, the way you were phrasing it. That's excellent.
That's kind of what I do every time is a play on words. T-O, T-W-O. It's fun.
Yeah, it was the only good thing about that Dumb and Dumber sequel was its title. Dumb and Dumber T-O.
I never saw it.
Well, you don't need to. I already told you the best joke about it.
Yeah, it's not a movie. I saw it in the theater.
I saw the original in the theater back in 1993 at the Norwood Cinema for $3.
Man, I miss Trevor. I don't know if you guys have, when you've been over here, you've driven by the plaza that has the Shaws in it before you get to my house. But behind that plaza is a big open area that used to be a movie cinema. We used to go there all the fucking time.
Oh, man.
And they didn't give a shit about anything. You could just like pay for one movie and then go see five. And that's probably why it doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, those small town cinemas were so much fun.
Yeah, Showcase Cinema in Revere used to be like that. They cut down real hard for their last like decade or so. But prior to that, it was awesome because I was, I think, 11 or 12, and me and a friend got tickets to see Casper, and then we went and watched Braveheart.
Nice.
I was just fucking thinking about Casper the other day. That's weird.
Oh, we saw it. We watched it the other day. It's fucking awful.
What the fuck? Why is there so much Casper in all of our lives right now?
Like, right? He's haunting us all.
we're talking about Christina Ricci, Bill Pullman, Casper, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, that's Bill Pullman. Like,
you know what's interesting is when that movie came out, you know, I was at the age where I was getting Happy Meals with toys in them, and I can still remember the smell of the plastic ghost toys that came with that Happy Meal.
That's a very specific odor, I can imagine.
They were glow-in-the-dark. I forget what the fuck their name, like Stinky and whatever the fuck their name were, whatever, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing when McDonald's does a tie-in to a movie like Casper and you get a Happy Meal, you never get the Casper toy. You always get like one of his dim-witted brothers or like one of the other characters.
Oh, it's like, I don't know, like, how does that work in the McDonald's? Do they just have like bins of all the toys all, like laid out like separately? Like, how do they decide who gets what? I forget like if we could request what toy we wanted and it was sort of like up to the discretion of the cashier or whoever puts together your order to give you the right one, or if they're just, you kind of just get what you got.
Well, I remember you could say like a Happy Meal for a girl or a boy, and you'd get like the boy toy or the girl toy.
Or like an under three too, because they had the bigger toys available with no moving parts. So I've only gamed the Happy Meal system once in my life, and it was in 1991, I'd have to imagine. Because that was when they had the Super Mario Brothers 3 toys. And what I did, and I ended up scoring all of the toys as a result of this, is I somehow managed my parents, who took us to McDonald's like once every 3 months. I somehow convinced them to take me to McDonald's 4 weeks in a row during this thing to get me a Happy Meal each week. And I got each toy. So like week one, I got Mario. Week two was Luigi. The next one was another one. The one following was another one. So it, at least at one point in time, went week by week. I don't think it's that organized anymore. I think they just get like a certain like thing of toys.
I didn't even know they still did like Happy Meal toy.
Yeah, I started getting Happy Meals a few years ago when it was, I think, for the Minions movie. And yeah. So we used to, me, Sasser, and Seth used to leave Cakewalk during the day when we were working. We'd go to the McDonald's nearby. I'd get a Happy Meal to try to get the little minion that said, what the fuck? Because they were all talking. And they all said mostly nonsense. But one of them said pretty clearly, what the fuck? I've actually got it in the other room. I can go get it and have it do the thing.
Man, I have a friend who I won't name. But like he gets into moods sometimes. And I'll be like in the car. And sometimes I just want to like pull into a McDonald's and not tell him what's happening. and just get a Happy Meal and then throw it at him.
That'll shut him up.
I'm going to do that at one point.
You know what? You know what, Jim? You bested me. You absolutely bested me with your Happy Meal. I will stop complaining. That's your friend.
All right, so Christopher is back. He's got a minion.
Oh, you summoned a minion.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think it might be dying because it's doing some really weird noises.
Oh, that's a what the fuck, all right. What the fuck is that thing doing? All right, you're going to have to cut that sucker open and replace the battery. Wait, please put that on the new record.
I think that's actually needs to go yes. on the new album. That's very good.
I've got a lot of clean audio of it in this very file, so I will definitely use it.
That's so good. One of the toys that we almost took Duke home with from his foster home was you remember Mr. Bill from Saturday Night Live in like the 90s?
Oh, no, it's Mr. Bill.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's a dog toy with like a voice box inside that when you squeeze it, he goes, oh no. And then the one that we that was at the foster home smelled like pee, so he didn't end up taking it. So we ordered a new one on Amazon, and he's already managed to rip the little voice box out.
That'll like, happen very quickly.
And it's very clearly says on there, this is not a toy, please discard immediately. It's like good thing we found it like, you know, not in the middle of the night or something like that. Or else he would
imagine
chewing on batteries.
Imagine if your dog swallowed the squeaker and like was fine, but like you could like squeeze him.
Squeeze him and you just hear like, oh, it's not doing it anymore. I gotta preserve this anyway.
I gotta backtrack a minute. So another movie title came out of what we were just talking about that Christopher said, Gaming the Happy Meal System. That's a. It's a new documentary coming out.
Yeah, first they had the documentary about the Monopoly pieces. Now they have one about the people who rig the Happy Meal system.
Oh my God, I remember that.
I just remember the guy from that documentary who he was like the FBI guy who just thought he was fucking king shit for taking this down.
Yeah, it was a pretty fascinating documentary.
It was. It was. That guy definitely had a little bit more pride than I think was warranted, but other than that, it was very good.
So, hey, yeah, Patrick, what are we doing today?
Hey, guys. Thanks for tuning in to another installment of Old Men Yell at Cloud. We're almost 20 minutes in, and I forgot to tell everybody what we're what you're listening to. Hopefully, you already know if you've already hit play on your little player and you can read. But if not, this is Old Men Yell at Cloud, and this is Patrick, and joined as always by Christopher Brown.
A woozle wuzzle.
And a little Jim Schultz.
Hey, I'm a little buzzed.
Good. Good. And we're good, here we are here this evening to discuss the 12th studio album by English rock band Genesis. And it's
that was shocking to me that it was their 12th album.
yeah. They it's their third of the 80s too. I forgot that they Abacab came out 2 years before that, and then Duke was in 1980. So they were busy. They were pretty busy, you know, starting from like 1970 or whatever, heading on. So this is the self-titled album from Genesis. Released on October 3rd, 1983 by Charisma and Virgin Records in the UK and by Atlantic Records in the US and Canada. This record followed the band's tour in support of their 1982 live album, Three Sides Live, and also, as mentioned before, 2 years after Abacab. Genesis took an 8-month break before they regrouped in the spring of 1983 to record a new album. The album was written and recorded in its entirety at their studio named The Farm in Chiddingfold. And the songs were developed. Chiddingfold.
Pardon me? Pardon me?
Not Chiddingfold. Chitting with a CH. You can't really hear the my CH and SH sounds are a little muted over Zoom, I think. CH.
That's a thing that I've been doing lately. Whenever Danielle and I are watching something or she says something that could sound like a swear or like some kind of innuendo, my response is always just a, pardon me?
So the songs were developed mostly through jam sessions in the studio with nothing written beforehand. Hugh Padgham returned as their engineer. We all know Hugh Padgham.
He's my boy.
Yes, good old Patty boy. Genesis, the self-titled record, that is, was the group's greatest commercial success at the time of their release, at least until their next record, The Invisible Touch, which was even huger, became the band's third straight album to reach number one. And five singles were released between 1983 and 1984. We got Mama, That's All, Home by the Sea, Illegal Alien, and Taking It All Too Hard, which was released 1 month before your baby boy Patrick was born in June 1984.
Do you think you were conceived to a song on this album?
I would think so. It kind of lines up because this is October. October. So let's see. October plus 9 months would probably take me to about July, right? Yeah. Or I guess it would be November. I don't know. They didn't buy it right away. The songs on this album. Genesis, the self-titled Genesis, displays the group moving towards shorter, more straightforward, and radio-friendly songs. Rutherford said that the band had gone as far as they could with their progressive and art rock direction, and they wanted to try a more relaxed approach, and the band were more driven to present what they had to offer. And it kind of, this album featured more writing and collaborative duties from Banks and Rutherford themselves. Yes, duties, like the poop. Main keyboards we got from Banks on this album, for any keyboard nerds out there like myself, he's using, obviously, his classic Yamaha CP70 electric grand piano. And he's got a little Arp Quadra, Prophet 10, synth clavier, and an Emu emulator, and then we got the Lin drum, all sorts of fun shit. All right, well, that's about all I have to say about this album for now. Why don't we go around the old Bruce Hornsby and talk about our favorite tracks? Jim, what's your favorite album? Wow, what is your favorite
my
song?
My favorite album off of the song Genesis is...
You know what I was trying to say, the thing. What's the thing, Jim?
South Carolina is seeping into his brain faster than we thought.
It's...
Patrick, how much fucking Huddle House did you eat today?
None, but I have a like ridiculous amount of pulled pork that I don't know what I'm going to do with. It should be, I mean, that should be brain food, right? It's protein, so... What the hell, man? What's wrong? Oh, it's probably all the beer I'm drinking.
Yeah, I ate and drank like an idiot today, so.
Just to be clear, you were working today, right?
I did the drinking part later on.
Okay.
But I had to get my truck service, so I was like, I'm going to stop at Five Guys because it's near the dealership. So I got that. And I was like, should I get the Five Guys and then bring it to the dealership and wait for them to finish my truck? And I was like, no, this smells pretty intense. I'm just going to eat it at Five Guys quick. So I shoved that down my gullet and then went to the dealership. And they were so backed up, the truck was going to end up taking 5 hours, so I had Emily come get me. And then when I told you guys I had to shoot down to Providence, it was because a friend of mine, actually Mike, who was just on for the In Utero episode, was like, they've got Hetty Topper at one of the liquor stores in Providence. And I was like, get the fuck out of here. So I had to shoot down and grab that. And then I ate Papagino's, and I ate too much of that. And here we are.
Oh, God. So you did Papagino's on top of the Five Guys?
Don't judge me, you fucking asshole.
This is not judgment. This is concern.
All right, you're gonna have to do a fucking what is it called? A not a safety check,
a well-being check.
You have to do a well-being check on me every 2 hours tonight to make sure I make it through the night.
Make sure you pass.
My chest is hurting a little bit, so. Anyways,
beer will put out that fire. Anyway, what's your favorite track?
I was gonna say, I always get Mama and Cry Little Sister from The Lost Boys confused for some reason. Cry Little Sister. When I went down to visit my friend Ryan in Houston, we got drunk and went out on the beach and were just screaming that all night long. It was fantastic. Anyways, my favorite track off this album is going to be Just a Job to Do. That song, so I was saying, like, my dad is a Genesis fan, so, like, I grew up listening to a lot of the Genesis songs, and this song is just fucking badass. The chorus is just, like, even as, like, a five-year-old, it just made me want to beat the shit out of somebody. Like, you know, you're just like...
Yeah, you know that Genesis feeling. You listen to Genesis.
yeah, I don't know. It's just fucking... It's a toe-tapper. It's fucking grooving, and then that fucking... That chorus kicks in, and it's just... You can feel the fucking passion in Phil Collins' voice during that.
Yeah.
And the hi-hat, it's got all the things I love.
Yeah, that's a great, great, like, deep track for Genesis that it sounds like that could have been a single, too. That easily could have been a single out of all of these on the album. And I said it kind of reminds me of Invisible Touch a little bit, but it definitely has its own kind of
Land of Confusion.
I mean, Land of Confusion, sorry. And yeah, that
you know
that,
what
that
it doesn't have,
great.
You know what it doesn't have, Patrick? Puppets.
Music video with puppets.
Yes.
A cover by Disturbed.
Yeah.
No, but that's a good point though. That you know, saying that the song kind of made you want to like kick the shit out of someone. The '80s Genesis, like it's funny because I was saying these guys can write a fucking '80s soft rock ballad like no one else, but like some of their like more rocking songs like were pretty fucking badass, and it's mostly his delivery that kind of like helps that along. That like he has that like very strong like high register delivery that like a lot of like metalheads I know like have a soft spot for Phil Collins and like this era of Genesis because of that.
Well, and don't leave Rutherford out of the equation either, because he's writing some fucking badass like metal riffs. Like
that too.
Disturbed played his riff as it was because it worked for a modern metal song.
Yeah, just like what they were doing rhythmically and like what they were kind of forced into being a three-piece without a proper guitarist or lead singer. And they kind of had to learn how to become a, you know, more of a studio act and, you know, kind of dumping all their ideas together rather than like, you know, writing things collaboratively. And yeah, I think it really informed, you know, where they would head for that decade, like instrumentally. It was kind of interesting. All right, Christopher, what's your favorite track?
Oh, my favorite track is going to have to be the first one that I heard off of this album. And I told you both before that the place where I heard this track was an episode of Magnum P.I. And that song is Mama.
Baba, Baba, I'm coming home.
That's the one. That's the one. It's way better than the Ozzy Osbourne version where he's like laughing. No, but Mama on this is awesome. It's just, you were talking before about them having some like kind of dark abilities in terms of conveying emotion, and Mama is exactly that. Like the subject matter of the song is a 17-year-old who's obsessed with a prostitute, and it's like, it's great. It's just such a great song, and Phil Collins' laugh during it is just, it's the stuff of magic.
He's like choking.
He didn't do anything as good as the laugh in Mama until they had that shot of him in the I Can't Dance video where they slowly zoom up his jeans until it like stops at his butt.
Yes. Oh, man. I do kind of love that song. It's so good. Mama is great, man. Yeah, that's a badass tune. The build in it is... It's a 7-minute slow burner, but damn, it pays off. It pays the fuck off.
Yeah, sure. A lot of times when there's a 7-minute lead single, it pays off. Not always. And I will say probably not most of the time, but there's definitely a lot of occasions where it does.
There's function to the length that's supposed to... Yeah, like...
Exactly. That's the big thing. It earns every minute.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I am going to actually pick the first song that I heard off of this album, and really it's really the first song I heard off this album simply because it's like such a ubiquitous track, and that is That's All. I fucking love this song. It's possibly one of my favorite 80s pop songs of all time.
It's a good one.
It's up there kind of with everybody wants to rule the world. To me, it's terms of like gold standard 80s pop, but it's like it's got a very different thing going on with it's not overly gated drums. I read it's like very influenced by like Ringo Starr and the Beatles. So obviously they just like, you know, muted the hell out of the drums, turned the overheads way down, turned the room mics down to get this like really kind of warm sound. But I've always fucking loved that song. Even when I was very young, just like it got that great melody to it.
It's a toe tapper.
It's a toe tapper. It's got this like great driving melody that like, just kind of goes throughout and everything just sounds well placed. That piano riff, that iconic CP70 piano riff is fucking great. Or I don't know if it's CP80 or CP70, but it's one of them. And yeah, great kind of like simple George Harrison-esque guitar from Mike Rutherford on that too, that I was just kind of noticing tonight, kind of in that tone, especially towards the end of it. It's one of my all-time favorite songs, and just like a kind of a gold standard pop song to me. His delivery is just it's so good. It's that hook, that vocal hook is so good. One of my favorites.
I wrote in my notes, and I mentioned this in the chat. Like, this song sounds like they like genuinely had a good time like writing and recording this song.
Yep. Yeah, I was like the video to that one where they're like in a factory or something like that, and they're just like eating soup and playing cards, and it's just like, yeah, something about like these like
something
guys
that Patrick's dreamed
down.
About his whole life, just eating soup in a factory and playing cards with his pals.
Yeah, you know,
I mean, that could very easily be a reality for you. That's not a difficult dream to achieve.
I figure it out.
I live literally 5 minutes from where the Industrial Revolution started, so I'm sure I can find an abandoned factory. You know, if you want to eat some soup and play some cards.
Or they built
sometime.
One of those gorilla mills for the first time.
Now, when you're eating the soup with your friends in the abandoned factory, what's your preferred method? Are you going to bring in like bowls and things like that, or are you just going to get a can opener and light a fire and put the can directly on the fire for heating purposes?
So if I recall in the video, they do have to keep warm around an open fire. But I think it's probably just, you know, less fuss to go with straight up cans, you know, just toss that right on the griddle or the fire rather, open it up. Burn the paper off. Who the fuck needs it? You know what you're eating.
That's I used to do that. I wanted to do it last time I went camping, and Emily was concerned, so I decided not to. But I would go to BJ's and get a fucking industrial-sized can of B&M baked beans. And I would just put it on the fucking fire for the whole weekend, and I would eat out of it. It was amazing.
Keep the fire going and just keep going back to the beans over the just grazing it over the course of the weekend. Mama, I'm out of beans.
It's like I don't know if you guys watched fucking Metalocalypse, but the episode where the Murderface, where he's just eating the can of beans the whole time, and he's just like, big old can of beans. He's like throwing them up.
He just keeps eating.
So your weekend beans, I was going to say it was like the most insane
thing. It's another
thing
movie
I've ever
title.
Heard.
Jesus, you're on a roll today, Christopher. Weekend beans. There we go.
Yeah, so your weekend beans, I was going to say it was absolutely insane, but then I realized it's not all that different from a tactic that Danielle and I have when we go to Iceland and we want to save money on food. We'll do a bag of sandwiches. So we'll go to the Bonus supermarket there, get a loaf of bread, get some peanut butter. We'll put the peanut butter on, like, we'll make sandwiches out of the entire loaf, and then we put it all back in the bread bag, and we carry that with us when we go places.
Oh, yeah. No, sometimes you got to just do that. Just have a, like, the time and, like, having to think of a place to go eat and, like, having to figure that out and, like, you know, wait in line, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes the pain in the ass, it's good to just have the food right there on hand.
Yeah, and it's pretty expensive to like eat out when you're on a rock in the middle of the Atlantic, too.
Yeah, exactly.
So you definitely save some money.
I got to tell you, that's one of the best things about Tokyo. If you get over there, all of the convenience stores are open like 24/7, and they have like the best like just pick up and go food you could ever fucking eat.
I've heard this before.
It's amazing. And they got whiskey, too. You can grab a little fucking nip of whiskey, you can grab your fucking, your rice, I forget what the hell they're called. They're these things that are, it's basically like a rice square wrapped in seafood, and they're usually like stuffed with different things, but those are fucking great. It's fucking amazing. And they get prepackaged sandwiches, and it's wonderful.
The rice thing, is that sushi?
No.
Okay, no, just it genuinely sounded like you were describing sushi.
No, Emily loves them. I forget what they have a name. I forget what the hell they're called, but those are good. But yeah, no, the convenience stores in Tokyo are fucking second to none.
They got this stuff. It's raw fish wrapped in seaweed and then has rice around it. I think it's called fishy seafood rice around.
Yeah, my old coworker had to go to Japan for work for a couple of weeks, and he basically lived out of the convenience stores.
Yeah, you can.
And was like, yeah, he's like, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, he had a company card, so I don't know why the fuck he was doing that, but, you know.
It's a little intimidating. I will say there was a time where I was like, I'm just going to get on the train and just go and get off at a random stop and wander around. Man, I wandered a long time, and it was like July and 95 degrees outside, and I was getting very dehydrated and hungry, and I was in like a neighborhood, and I was like, oh god, like I was afraid because most, like, when you're in Tokyo, most of the establishments, like, they speak a decent amount of English, or they have menus where you can like kind of point to things, and I was in like this neighborhood where, like, I feel like that wasn't going to happen, so I was terrified to go into a restaurant and be like, I don't know, and like cry and run out. But no, everybody's super fucking nice over there.
Nice. Well, if you're at home and you're listening in and you get the chance to go to Japan, go.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. If we're the podcast that introduces you to the country of Japan, then good on us. Good on us.
Hey, yeah, I mean,
I was listening to those old men
information episode before.
Japan. I've never heard of this place.
Oh, those old men yell at Cloud Boys. We're talking about this brand new country. It's called Japan.
Well, maybe, just maybe, this is our second information episode. Oh. We've already had one.
we can have
also,
more than one.
Also, a throwback to an old episode. If you're in Japan, don't forget to check out the Claw Machine of Nightmares.
That's right.
And the lobby of the building where Jim peed on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yep. International incident number 1 of 3.
Interpol's got a whole dossier on you. I know that.
My
do.
Fucking face is on every in every international airport around the globe. Do not let this man into this country.
What do you think
this man pee in your country?
What do you think that the people who are investigating Jim at Interpol call him? Like, what's their nickname for him as a criminal?
Ooh. I would say
probably White Pudge Man or something.
No, like Goldie Streaks or something like that. Something pee related.
The Pudge. They call me the Pudge. Yeah, we just got to tip the Pudges coming over the border. I don't know why they talk like they're fucking from New Jersey, but
well, some of Interpol is. You never know where they're from. Yeah, maybe the foyer flutter. The foyer floodgates.
Oh, there we go.
I would like to think that I'm on some obscure Japanese television show where they make fun of white people, and they're just like replaying me running like on like CCTV, like running into the lobby and looking around and not knowing what to do and just fucking pissing all over the floor.
Fast forwarding, looping it, and reversing it and stuff with like Benny Hill type sound effects happening. What a slide whistle.
Jim, Chief.
And that's how we learned that Jim was the second most popular character in Japan.
Hey, my fucking finance teacher in college was like number 10 on like electronic radio in Japan for a while. And he was like, I don't know how that fucking happened. But anyways, what was your question, Patrick?
Jim, what's your least favorite track on this album?
My least favorite track is going to be Second Home by the Sea. You know, why do you got to rub it in your face that you already have a home, home by the sea, but you got a fucking second home by the sea? Like, come on, Phil Collins.
Phil
we know
Collins,
you're full
man.
Of money. You could just got money coming out of your ass, but we don't know. But seriously, I don't know. I just felt like, and I know you guys are like synth heads and shit, but I just felt like the synths in that were cheesy. And there was one point where I was like, I don't know how I feel about this instrumental. And like literally as I was writing instrumental, Phil Collins started singing, and I was like, oh, god damn it.
Yeah. It's mostly an instrumental. Yeah.
The synths on this song, actually, the synths on this album, I will say, I'm a pretty big synth head. I love synth music, but I think that the synth choices on this album are mostly on notice. They're fine. They're just on this side of acceptable, but they're close to being bad. Like, I, for one, don't really like the, was it the CP90?
Yeah.
The Yamaha.
Oh, the
Yamaha
classical, yeah.
CP70, rather. The classical piano. Like, I do not like that sound whatsoever. It's like claws on a chalkboard to me. So there are some questionable synth choices on this record, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about that one, too. And it's also, it's a two-part suite, but it doesn't, like, really do a lot. It's, like, about 11 minutes total. And like, I think you kind of get the gist of it by the first one. The second suite doesn't really do much, and it's about 6 minutes of that. And yeah, there's a lot of cheesy synth happening. Some good melodies, but also some kind of bad melodic choices happening here and there too.
I would have liked a little bit more in the way of callbacks too, if they were presenting this as a suite of songs. They were basically just like two songs that segued together, as opposed to feeling like they were composed as a single piece.
Yeah, this one sounds more like it was probably jam oriented, and like, probably more like the three of them were playing it in a room. And look at that! It actually says right here, "Second Home by the Sea," a mostly instrumental piece developed from a group improvisation that began with Collins playing a drum fill, which Banks and Rutherford liked and joined in. And the working title was Heavy Simmons. Okay. Simmons with a D.
Okay.
I also enjoy when I'm playing a drum beat and my friends, you know, join in.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah, you know, Jimmy, you play a drum beat. play a drum beat, your friends join in, the soup's on the fire, everything is right in the world.
Oh, yeah. The beans are on the fire. Crack that open. Not too much, though, just half open so you can still hold some of the heat in.
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing weekend beans correctly, that's how you need to do it.
Keep the flies out, too, probably.
Hey, Jim, here's a question that I...
Can that just be the title of the new Rampikes album, Weekend Beans?
I am 100% okay with that, but we got to clear it with one other person. I've got a question for you, Jim, that I'm horrified to think that I think I know the answer to this.
Oh, no.
But when you get a can of beans like that, what do you do with the lump of fat?
I mean, the person who I used to go camping with and do this with, I think we just let it fucking float around in there.
Okay. I am very relieved to hear that is the answer.
So I'm going to let you guys in a little extra tidbit of information that might upset you. I don't know. So we'd cook the beans at night and then we'd let the fire go out and we just put tin foil over the can and let it sit all day. And then we'd relight the fire at night and reheat the beans. So they were pretty exposed for most of the weekend.
Hmm. Yeah, I wonder, like, what is there in beans, though, that can really go bad?
No, that's
what
I'm...
molds would be your biggest...
No, I mean...
offender, and that's too short-term for molds to really be a thing.
So the first time we did this, we didn't know how to use a manual can opener correctly. So there were shards of metal in the can of beans. So we had to take extra caution while we were eating the beans at night because we couldn't really see. No, I think the biggest concern was an animal getting into the can of beans while we weren't around.
Well, yeah. I'd be concerned with that, too. The sugar
How long does a can of baked beans last once opened? The precise answer depends on a large extent on storage conditions. Keep open baked beans refrigerated and tightly covered.
Nope.
So if they're refrigerated, it says 3 to 4 days.
Yeah. See, the thing with like leaving it outside, it has sugar in it, right? Like it's in like kind of a sugary
sugar,
sauce.
Sugar, baby.
Yeah, it's like molasses, yeah, brown and sugar,
yeah,
and
with
tomato.
Molasses. Yeah, anything with sugar like that is just, you know, that's inviting mold. It's food for fucking bacteria and mold. So
I think
see
that's
that
really quick though for mold.
In the right temperature, going off like within 2 days.
Well, I mean, he covered it with tinfoil. What else do you want from him?
I'm all still right here. And he's only had a little bit of brain damage.
Now here's the thing though, if you keep the fire going, so it's actually the beans are in like a sort of, it's in like the temperature safety zone that they, whatever, yeah, fucking but, OSHA teaches you.
But it's Patrick, like, it wasn't.
Yeah, no, it was out during the summer day when he was camping.
Yeah.
No, but like you said that you put it on the fire, right?
Yeah, but the fire would go out in the night and then it would be just sitting there all day, and then we'd light the fire again at nighttime. During right, the day it was
I suppose
the
if
Wild
you cook
West
it hot enough, I suppose if you cook it hot enough, it's probably not that dangerous. But I mean, I am not a scientist, so please, if you're listening, do not take what I just said as medical advice.
Just eat your beans. It's going to be okay.
We have two different opinions here. Well, one guy's saying, don't eat the beans. The other guy's saying, eat the beans.
Listen,
I just want to grill, goddammit.
I, in fact, am a scientist, and I'm telling you, the beans are okay.
The beans are fine.
What are we doing again?
Christopher, what's your least favorite song?
Oh, we're supposed to do Christopher's least favorite song, right?
Yeah.
I am going to go with Illegal Alien.
Of course.
This song is a monstrosity on a number of levels. It's just a shitty song for starters.
It's weird.
Way too long. He's trying to do a Mexican accent in it, from what I can understand.
Yes.
But the weird thing is, like, pretend you don't know that and pull up the song in your mind's ear and think to yourself, this sounds a little bit like Men at Work.
Yeah, and it does.
I totally, 100%, that's what I was hearing until someone said, oh, it's a Mexican accent. And I'm he's trying to do a Mexican accent, but he sounds like weirdly Australian when he's doing it.
It sounded Jamaican to me.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell he's trying to do, but obviously, like, it's probably not acceptable by modern standards. But, the thing is, I like Men at Work. I didn't like this song. The song failed on all of the accounts where Men at Work usually succeed. I can't say anything good about this song. This is like fucking bottom of the barrel Genesis as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, guess what? I'm going to go ahead and jump on that bandwagon.
I'm surprised it wasn't a sweep, to be honest.
Well, we'll get into why Jim loves this song in a moment. You guys actually picked the two songs that I would have picked for least favorite, because like every single other song on this album, fucking slaps, according to me. The first Home by the Sea is kind of bad, but everything else is great. But Illegal Alien, my note was just, it's just fucking offensive all around. There is some kind of fun stuff that happens, but yeah, that bridge goes on for way too long, and like 5 minutes for a single that's like supposed to be kind of throwaway, that's a bit ridiculous. Like it's longer than like significantly better songs on this album that could, you know, the time could have been used a bit more efficiently. There's a lot of dumb shit that happens.
This isn't a terribly long album at 45 and change, but if they had pulled this song off of it, it would have been closer to 40, and man, this would have been such a better album. So much tighter if they pulled that song off of it.
Yeah, it would have been a breeze for sure. And it would have been four songs on each side. And
realistically, Second Home by the Sea, it's not like their best song, but it's so much more acceptable. Like, I think that this album would have been up like an entire letter grade or two by removing that song. That's how much I fucking hated it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's extremely silly. I don't know. Let's move on. Jim, what was your MVP moment on this album?
It wasn't. I didn't love that song.
I know.
Fuck you. I thought it was entertaining that he was trying to do a Jamaican Mexican accent.
The famous Jamaican Mexican accent.
Yeah. My MVP moment is going to be in Mama. And, you know, we were talking about this song and how fucking it delivers as a 7-minute song and just how it fucking builds, you know, and it kind of starts off with that Lindrum and builds. And my MVP moment is actually going to be when that fucking iconic Phil Collins drum sound comes in.
God damn you. That was
the gated snare.
Yeah.
Fuck, that was mine.
The gated snare is just delightful.
Chef's kiss. Like, that's what it was invented
for. I don't love it on everything, but yeah, it really has its places, and there are a couple of tracks on this album where it really deserves to be there.
I think the darkness of that song, it fits perfectly in there.
It makes it super heavy. Like,
yeah.
Like we were saying, like, it just has this, it's, you know, it's not heavy metal. It's not like a metal track with like huge distorted, you know, guitars and 60th note bass drum kicks or whatever. But it's like, it's just heavy. It has this like heavy tone to it that, like, you know, I could see metal bands taking influence from. And yeah, it's great, great use of dynamics throughout the whole thing.
It's Chino Moreno heavy. He will talk about things that are heavy that aren't traditionally heavy. Yeah. Like, he'll like list a couple Cure songs as like the heaviest songs he's ever heard. And it's just like, it's about taking like the mood and the density of everything involved and looking at the whole picture, as opposed to, does this have really distorted guitars on it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the difference between a, you know, a lightweight song and a heavyweight song too. Just sometimes the tone can add so much to the weight. Cristoforo, what was your MVP moment?
Oh man, we already talked about this song, but I want to bring it up again just because of Mike Rutherford's tasty bass grooves. And that is just a job to do.
His
bass work on that is just
stupendous.
Chef's kiss. Yeah. Oh yeah. No, that's A tier bass playing right there.
Yeah, I wrote dope bass line.
Yeah. Hell yeah. So Jim already took my MVP moment, which is like, god damn it. Like it's so good. It's so iconic. And then I had a few others that I was thinking of, like the organ solo and That's All, but I don't want to pick something from my favorite track. I think I'm actually going to go with an underrated moment, maybe, which is the, man, I don't know if you would call it a chorus, but it's like a B section in the B sections and Taking It All Too Hard. Underrated pop ballad from those guys. Definitely didn't like make it as big as some of the other ones, but yeah, just something about that one is like just so satisfactorily written to me. Just like the way the chords kind of interplay, and yeah, the B sections kind of modulate into minor, and it really adds this like great kind of progressive pop tone over everything. Great evidence of what these guys could do. You know, they were obviously great prog writers for a long time, back in the Peter Gabriel days. And then, they were really, you know, had a lot of strengths as pop songwriters too. Even in those prog days, they did, like little elements of that. But, you could really start to see, their pop songwriting muscle get really strong by this record. In under 4 minutes, they managed to say a lot with, you know, what could easily be perceived as sort of like a lightweight pop ballad. They actually do quite a bit in those B sections and kind of throughout. All right. Okay. Let us move to the next section. Jim.
Hi.
Schultz, what's your comparable album?
Hello. You actually mentioned, I hope you weren't going to pick this. You mentioned Everybody Wants to Rule the World. And I'm going to go with Songs from the Big Chair by Tears for Fears. It's got similar vibe. You know, it's got that, the beeps and boops, but the emotional kind of aspect to it too that really, you know, fucking... Yeah, everybody wants to rule the world is one of those like ones that like makes me want to just stand on my roof and quit my job and.
Yeah, it's a super strong track.
Passionate songs.
Those boys, Christopher, what about you?
I am going to go with another 80s album by a career rock band that lost a key member prior to the making of this record, although Genesis had a few years in between. I guess there were a few years here too, but Genesis had a couple albums to kind of get into their groove.
All right, at any rate, Chester Bennington.
Yes. At any rate, I'm going to go with Pink Floyd's 1987, A Momentary Lapse of Reason. I think that there was a lot of playing around with the same sort of technology while also trying to maintain some of the, like, Pink Floyd was never really like prog, but trying to maintain the sort of like pop prog, I guess you could call Pink Floyd, in what they were doing, along with utilizing drum machines and gated reverbs and things like that.
Right on.
Yeah. Ooh.
Nick Mason's like coming to town or some shit.
Yeah, he's doing like a Saucer Full of Secrets tour, right?
I'll drink from his saucer.
Gross.
Boy, my name's Nick Mason. I could do this all by myself. I don't need fucking Roger Waters or fucking David Gilmour.
That's how he talks, I assume. That just picture being like a one-man band on stage.
I remember watching...
like a car horn on his foot. Big bass drum.
I remember watching... I think it was one of those classic albums on VH1 or whatever, and they were doing... I think it was the Dark Side of the Moon one. It was one of the Dark Side of the Moon like documentaries or whatever. And they were in Abbey Roads, and they had Nick Mason and Alan Parsons. And it just seemed like... Nick Mason wanted nothing to do with what was happening. He's just like, Alan Parsons was like, oh yeah, I remember I did something. He's like, yeah, whatever. Like, he didn't seem like he was having it.
Yeah, I don't think he was thrilled with the final drum sound on this album, but like, that was kind of Roger Waters' whole thing. He insisted that they make the drums sound like it was recorded inside a box, right?
Yeah, I have no idea. I can't speak to that.
Well, fuck off. My comical right. album.
See you guys later.
All right.
That's cool. Christopher.
We're a two-piece now. And then there were two,
right?
Yeah, Genesis.
Genesis jokes all day long.
Oh, the kids, they love them. My pick is going to be Hall & Oates' Private Eye. This is Private Eyes. Record from, I think it was 1981. Obviously, two groups that didn't have, you know, a lot in common in terms of their history, but like at that point in both groups' careers, they were kind of doing like pop music. It was very much like geared towards like pop melodies and stuff, but There was like a little something more, a little something extra, like they were kind of throwing on top. So, you know, I would call it a kind of like 80s progressive pop or whatever the 80s version of that was. Also, just like so many slamming singles off that album and a lot of great. It's just a good mix of, you know, great singles and great deep cuts and slamming 80s production all over and the. Dulcet tones of Daryl Hall and Phil Collins.
I gotta say, I hope at some point in my life I can just find a sack of oats and I can throw it over my shoulder and somebody could be like, what are you doing? And I could tell them I'm hauling oats.
I sang it in my head as you were saying that joke. I loved it. I really want to get two horses and name them Hall and Oates.
I wanted to get two. I told Emily this. It's like when I retire, I want a farm, and I want to have two goats, two black and white goats named Jake and Elwood.
That's a good combo.
All right, let's we're coming up on an hour here. We're over an hour now, so let's rate this thing. Jim, what do you rate this album, Genesis, self-titled from 1983?
I'll give it a 7. Middle of the road 7. You know, it's not something that I've ever gone out of my way to listen to. I enjoyed it. Man, there's some hits on there that I, you know, kind of sparked some childhood memories. And that's about it.
Christopher, what about you?
Middle of the road 7 for me as well. If Illegal Alien was not on this album, it would be a strong 8. I really like everything else on this album. I know you guys didn't love Second Home by the Sea as much, but I still liked it. Like, again, the synth selections were a little cheesy and things like that, but I can forgive a lot based on the date of when something was recorded. So that's one of those things like that. But yeah, it's going to be a middle of the road seven just because of that stupid fucking song.
And you know, these guys were like in their 30s at that point. This is like, you know, Rampike's putting out an album. Like, give us a break. We're old, okay? We're trying to be cool. We don't know, though. We don't know.
Yeah, I mean, as far as Genesis goes, I'm fucking going Invisible Touch, so.
100%, me too. Invisible Touch, honestly, for me, is probably a 10. Like, I fucking love that album.
There is some... I think I need to go back and revisit a few tracks. I feel like there are some that were... Maybe I'm mixing it up with some of the ones on We Can't Dance, but that's one I'm not as familiar with. I don't really know why. But this album, I am giving an 8 to. And I think I'm in the same boat as Christopher, where it might get a higher rating if Illegal Alien wasn't on here. For me, this is the most consistently good Genesis album. And it's funny to say that, because of their kind of like the length and dearth of material they have in their career. And obviously they have like a whole era with a different lead singer that's, you know, a lot more celebrated and things of that nature. But to be completely honest, I actually prefer Peter Gabriel solo to the shit that he did with, early Genesis.
Same. Definitely.
And a lot of that stuff is like, there's some great shit, but there's also a lot of fucking nonsense. And even once we get into the Phil Collins years, Duke is great. I fucking love Duke. Not just my dog, but the album. But it's a slog. It's like 56 minutes long, which is like way too long for an album at that time period. And then like Abacab is kind of all over the place too. But for me, like this one is like the first one that I could listen to front to back. With the exception of Illegal Alien. Sometimes if I'm feeling generous, I'll just fucking leave that playing. But this one, like, there's just so many other great tracks. I would give it a higher rating if the production was a little more consistent. I realize it was kind of tough doing that with the types of songs that they were writing. They were trying to sort of toe two different lines of like the soft rock and like the 80s arena rock. Which obviously kind of requires two completely different sonic spaces. But because of that, it's like a little disorienting to go from something like That's All, which is like very warm and intimate, to Home by the Sea, which is all fucking gated reverb and like all these digital synths. And it's like, they sound like 10 years apart at times. But the songs themselves are fucking solid. And yeah, like I said, this is like one of my favorite Genesis records. So it's an 8. For me.
What? So I'm looking at you were talking about Duke, and I realized that one of my favorite Genesis songs is Misunderstanding, and so I just popped over to the Duke Wikipedia, and under the personnel credits here, so Tony Banks, Phil Collins, obviously guitar, drums, but they both played a duck. What the fuck does that mean?
Wait, what?
They squeeze in ducks? The hell is this?
I don't remember this. What the fuck? I remember hearing a duck on Misunderstanding. Hold on.
No. Just on the album, Duke. It says Phil Collins, lead vocal, drums, drum machine, percussion, duck. Tony Banks, keyboards, backing vocals, 12-string guitar, duck.
That's fucking hilarious.
These guys are squeezing ducks.
It was a duck call used to trigger a sound on a CS-80.
Interesting. The more you know.
I almost did that album tonight instead. Like I said, it's a bit more of a slog, and like I would recommend checking that one out there if you like Misunderstanding. It has a lot of great like soft rock ballads on it. It's not as fun and like heavy as this one is, but like, if you're into like the kind of sweet songwriting that they do, that one is a very lovely record otherwise. And Abacab is good too. It's just not as consistent. And I think at points they're trying to go back to the 70s prog thing and it doesn't quite work in the 80s aesthetic. But a lot of people like that album, so don't listen to me if you want to check that one out. I'm talking to the audience now. I'm not talking to you guys. Fuck you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Price is Right rules.
Oh, shit.
Bill Collins, net worth.
Man.
Oh, he's going to be worth a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
You'll be my heart.
Yeah, all right. He wrote a lot of schlock. It's decades.
It's Patrick's episode, so I'm going to let him go first.
Man, I don't know. See, it's... He hasn't had a hit in a long time either, but they're still definitely playing Genesis quite a bit on, like, WROR when I would, you know, listen to the classic
rock
station. Yeah, quite a bit from Invisible Touch, actually. I'm going to go with, man, I don't know, 300 million.
Christopher?
$1.
Patrick nails it right on the head. Phil Collins at $300 million.
Wait, no, are you serious?
I'm serious, yeah.
How the fuck is that possible? Wow. Wow.
Yeah, no, I was going one of the richest. He was one of the richest rock stars in the world.
Yeah, I mean.
I think he's in like the top 10 or 20.
He's up there. No, he's definitely up there. I was fucking going kind of on Paul the low end.
Fucking Paul McCartney's worth like $1.2 billion at this point. It's insane.
Yeah. Well, he and this fellow Lennon wrote some songs together, and my understanding is that those songs did pretty well.
Yeah, I think I've heard of him.
And, you know, like two successful solo careers in Wings and by himself, too, also.
Now, this is really interesting to me. Bono is worth $700 million, right?
Yeah.
And he has ventures outside of U2, so that makes sense to me. Next richest member of U2 is Adam Clayton at $400
million.
Clayton is richer than Phil Collins.
I thought Larry Mullen Jr. was worth $500 million because he's one of the richest. He is the richest drummer, I think.
Larry Mullen Jr., at least at this list that I'm looking at, is $300
million. Oh, okay.
Same as Phil.
Yeah. They got fans worldwide, though. Like, they're one of those bands that, like, fucking everybody all around the world loves. Genesis, too. Like, you know, like, some bands only do well in America. Some bands only do well in Europe. Like,
true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, like, they have, like, you know, all over the fucking place. Who doesn't love a nice U2 song? Come on, what's wrong with you? You don't like...
Oh, no.
It's all right. It's all right, baby.
Catorze!
That's the one. Gets you off ready.
Gives you vertigo.
Yeah, that's for sure. All right. Well, that was fun. That was fun. Thanks for joining in. Did we do everything? Yes, we did.
We did.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I should probably go to check on my dog. Jim, you have anything you want to plug?
The mixes I did for Nightmaric Music are dropping on Halloween, which as of this episode, we dropped this on November 1st, so it'll be yesterday. Check those out. We're also working on our new Rampikes album. The drums are all done and Christopher's plugging away at the bass. And then also I am gonna fucking start attempting to build my YouTube channel. Well, you can come and learn all kinds of tidbits about drumming and whatnot. So the official, I think, branding I'm going to use that is called Drum Smarts. So yeah. Drumsmarts.com will be the URL once it's up and running.
Jim Schilt's Masterclass, everybody.
Yeah.
It's going to teach you how to drum right after eating a Schilt's dinner.
It's not going to be as good as the. Did you guys see the new Masterclass? Metallica.
There's a Metallica one. Yeah,
being in a band. It's like, oh my god! You know, fucking like a bunch of guys. Like middle aged dudes are like drooling over there. Like, oh man, I could still be in a band. I just got to watch this Metallica masterclass, and we're going to do it, guys. We're going to get some Crispy Boys. You guys
have it figured out.
Yeah.
You know what helps? Money. Lots and lots of money. Turns out that's a big help. All right, cool. Christopher, got anything cooking?
I would also like to promote drumsmarts.com.
Oh, thanks.
But I would like to put a disclaimer out there for people that this is going to be an 18-plus channel. So you can expect nudity at times, although it will be tasteful.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'll put tape only across tasteful. My nipples.
All right. I got a new Smell album coming out. I have to push it back because, I don't know, I just have too much shit going on and want to make sure I spend the time on it that it deserves. So that's coming out on December 3rd. Friday, December 3rd.
Patrick's busy watching his dog dream about suckling nipples, so.
Yes, exactly. It's very important. Problem is he only does that for like 10 minutes at a time, and then he's up and he starts like whining and wanting to play. He dreams about
suckling nipples, and then he wakes up and then he suckles on Patrick's nipple.
Yeah.
Patrick feels good.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you have a dream that you're eating pudding and then you wake up with a spoon in your ass.
Speaking of dogs suckling on nipples, I've told you guys that Rigby has like bit my nipple at least 3 times at this point. I don't know what it is. He knows where they are and he just goes for them.
I mean, stop flaunting what you got.
No, I'm not doing anything. He'll just
That's
be like
gym
fucking...
bacon. That's where the gym bacon is. It's the good stuff.
The gym bacon.
Yeah,
I'll eat my own bacon. I don't care.
Yeah, it'll just grow back. That's what happens if you eat your own hand.
Am I like a lizard?
Grow another hand. Yeah.
I mean, I've been eating my own hand for the last 35 years, and it still keeps growing back. So I guess so.
I mean, eat your own hand once, shame on you. Eat your own hand twice, shame on science.
Mm-hmm. All right, we should probably wrap this up because I'm at a level of drunk right now where I'm probably going to say something I regret. So, okay. if I haven't already.
All right, yeah. So anyway, yeah, Smell album Toe coming out December 3rd, 2021. Yeah, thanks again for tuning in to another installment of Old Men Yell at Cloud and for listening to a little podcast on our little Zero Science Network. Check out some of our other fun programmed on the Zero Science Network, like Jukebox Zeros, which I am also a part of. And we got Clamshell Case Files, World of Commotion, all sorts of fun stuff. When Scary Meant Stabby is the new one that Christopher's doing with Scott Kerland.
I haven't listened to my episode yet.
Yeah, the last episode of that will be dropping yesterday as of when this comes out.
Oh, yes, it's an October thing, and this is November 1st, of course. So we'll be moving on to When Turkey Met Chicken.
I'll do that show.
Podcast. Sounds good. Yeah, I love it. All right, yeah, so leave us a review. Find us on iTunes, We're on Spreaker as well. So leave us a review if you find us. You know, love us, hate us. Just tell us what you think. And be sure to listen to some of those other programs as well. And tell your friends about our shows and how much they enhance your lives. Please.
Play them at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, play them at Thanksgiving. Play them for your family. I couldn't think of a better, like, icebreaker for, you know, a tense Thanksgiving dinner than just throwing on one of our episodes. You and your uncle MAGA, you got some, you know, differing opinions on things, and you throw this on and you guys could just be like, wow, at least we aren't these sad, pathetic assholes talking about the toadies. do that. And thanks once again for checking out the show. This has been Old Men Yell at Cloud, and this is Patrick.
I am Christopher.
I am Jim, and I hope the aliens are listening. We'll see you in hell.
I hope so, too.
We'll come here, you and Jim. Thank you.
science.
Lils and Patrick are two local musicians from the New England area whose minimal accomplishments have left them thoroughly unqualified to judge bands and artists who have been more successful than they ever could be. And yet, their passion for bad music persists on Jukebox Zeros, the podcast that takes a retrospective look at the worst albums of all time. From The Shags to Attila, from Cyberpunk to Scream, if there's a band that has an album they're ashamed of, Lils and Patrick will be there. Share their love on Jukebox Zeros, now on the Zero Science Network, and wherever podcasts may be found.